So this is the first, I guess, episode you would call it, of Cover to Cover with new series I'm trying for the site. So this is Jordan Blum, the founder and editor-in-chief of the Bookends Review. And I'm here with Bruce Bauman, author of Broken Sleep, which was released last year on Other Press. So Bruce, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here and your first guest, and I hope it works out.
Yeah, me too. We'll see. And also, thanks for all the support you've given the journal over the past year or so, I guess.
My pleasure. Having worked with Black Hawk and other journals, we all need to support each other.
No, absolutely. This is one of many steps I'm going to try to take prior to AWP in February to sort of try to get us more known and more established and just bring more things into it.
Okay.
So the first question, sort of a minor question, but I couldn't help but ask that. I've noticed that images of Broken Sleep have blue, green, and pink covers, and I have the pink cover one. So I wonder if those are actually all available variants, and if so, why these colors and why these three options?
Well, yes, they all are available, but if you buy it from Amazon, you can't choose what color you want. Send whatever. It's some kind of like the lottery. Terry Akers, who is my editor and also works in the marketing department,
mm-hmm.
as well, and Other Press is a good sized company, but it's still a small company. She suggested the idea of three separate colors because of Salomé Savant being an artist, and we all love the one cover that was done, so we went with that, and I think it's been relatively successful. When I've had readings, it's always interesting to see which color sells the most, and it's there's never been a consistency to it.
Oh, I mean, I do like the pink one the most out of the three, I guess. But it's interesting.
Everybody has, that was the first one, then we went with blue, and we were going to try a gold one, and that didn't work out so well, so then it was green. I'm happy with all three. I love it, and a couple of people have even bought a few copies so they could have all the colors, which has been
amazing. Wow. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Sort of to a more in-depth question, I guess. So Broken Sleep came out last year, whereas its predecessor, And the Word Was, came out nearly a decade prior, 2006. So wondering what ways did the publication of that first novel, as well as having so many years in between the two, impact your approach to Broken Sleep?
So many years is just because I'm slow, and the book is 120 pages, and I rewrote it between 8 and 9 times.
Oh, wow.
When I started it until when it came out, and I got some really great editorial advice from Terry and Anjali Singh and Alan Peacock and some other people. So that was the approach. The books to me thematically have some things in common, but structurally they're completely different. And you know, whereas And the Word Was takes place over a year, this takes place in, you know, over 80 years, Broken Sleep. So, and it's a multiple narrator, and I worked on it. So from the beginning, it was all the narrations start in different time, but for the last section, they would all meet up in the final present of the novel, all the different narratives. So it was just a long process. You know, I had fun doing it, but sometimes getting the right order of the narrative chapters was work. That was hard.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, it's a very ambitious structure, and it makes it very interesting to just read and see who's going to speak next and how your writing changes depending on who the character is, you know, the mouthpiece of the chapter.
Yeah, the voices, you know. Obviously, the novel wouldn't succeed if the voices were not different. I mean, each one is chapters. There's the Songs of Salome and Memoirs of a Useless Good for Nothing, and you know, the Book of Moses. But for me, I use those as chapter headings because I had a lot of fun making all the different puns for the different chapter headings.
Yeah,
but One should be able to pick up the book, not look at who is speaking, and just from reading it, know which of the main narrators it is,
mm-hmm.
because their voices, I hope, are so different.
No, absolutely. That definitely works. And as I said, it keeps it really engaging.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to also say that you just mentioned in comparison to the previous book, that they both share some similarities. And I noticed that they both deal with culture, religion, specifically Judaism, and the uncertainties of life. That Broken Sleep resonated with me. I mean, I admit that I identify, agnostic, but I am Jewish technically. So certain things did definitely remind me of my bar mitzvah and all of that, going to Hebrew school and all that. So I wonder, though, does that mean that you use your fiction as a vessel through which you can tackle your own questions and issues about the world?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, I consider myself a Jewish atheist,
yeah,
but still a struggle. And undoubtedly that the questions that Anne the Word was addressed in terms of how to live in a world without God comes through in a different form in Broken Sleep. In Broken Sleep, I didn't address that as directly, but the moral way in which to live and how to sort of survive, that's a big question. And the question, both books deal with loss in different ways, and I think for me, accepting that is a huge part of my fiction. And all the characters, in the main characters in both books as well as my short stories, are always trying to come to terms with dealing with a life that is essentially mostly disappointing, at least from my pessimistic point of view.
Yeah. And of course,
you take what you can from your little victories, you know.
Yeah, and of course, the inherent sort of Jewish guilt that comes along with all of it, too.
There's Jewish guilt, but essentially it turns out the Moses character who thinks he's a Jew in Broken Sleep is not. The main characters, I mean, of Alchemy, Salome, Moses, Jay, none of them, and Ricky McFinn, a.k.a. Ambitious Mindswell, none of them were actually Jewish, so... I wanted to play with what that identity really means if you think you are a Jew, as Moses does for most of his life, and then suddenly he finds out that his biological mother is a Christian and his biological father was basically a Nazi. How does that how does that change your identity from what you thought you were for 40 years of your life?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a very important unlooked at aspect, especially right now in America, of how people identify themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily think it's a good thing to have certain kind of clannish affiliations.
I agree. Leads to a lot of polarization and superiority, inferiority complexes, and just a lot of bad things in general. Well,
yeah, and I mean, we've just seen that.
Yeah.
That how much racism, sexism, and those kinds of identifications can play out negatively.
Yeah, and I do want to come back to that actually in a little bit.
Okay.
So I guess going along with the of you tackling some of these issues and questions, do you think it's inevitable that all creative types, maybe especially authors, I guess, maybe, or musicians too, anybody who writes, I guess, put some of themselves and their experiences into their work? Do you think that is inevitable?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable, but what I am absolutely convinced of, you start out from your real life experiences and even potentially base characters on people that you know or have met or studied. Mm-hmm. But if the characters don't take over and become their own special character, the fiction will not work.
Yeah.
So, we filter our real life experiences into the fiction. I mean, you know, I've never actually known anyone like Salome, but she was talking to me all the time. I base little bits of her character on people I've known, and some of her artistic creations, I admit, are based on some of my wife's artistic creations, some not. But if they don't become alive and talk to you as individuals, and maybe this is slightly psychotic, then the fiction fails. And for me as a reader, I actually often think I can feel when a character has taken over a novel in the way I think they should, and when the author is making the character speak the way they think they should. And there's a huge difference, and you can't teach that, and you can't make it happen, because I've had characters I wanted to write and they never came alive to me, and I've had to jettison them.
Yeah, it's always that sort of interesting, I guess, divide between, sort of in a larger scope, like forcing yourself to write for an hour or two a day and just going, versus sort of waiting until inspiration actually strikes, and then it'll just kind of bleed out of you. That's a struggle I find myself in a lot, too.
Well, I think if you, for me, I'm a lazy bastard.
So
if I waited for inspiration, I'd be watching TV and sports and reading and hanging out with my wife the rest of my life. I believe very strongly when I'm writing a book, if I'm not writing, I spend at least an hour a day with it by myself, reading what I've already written or just dreaming about it, and I make myself write. When I'm teaching, it's different. I can't go every day, but in the times that I'm off, I go every day for hours to my studio, and I rewrite. Rewriting is the key to everything. There are very, very few people, maybe nobody, who can write a great first version of a novel. I don't know anyone. So inspiration, it comes, and, you know, I often awake in the middle of the night with ideas. I don't want to call them inspired, because a lot of the ideas often suck when I look at them in the morning. But sometimes they're really good, and I run with them during the day, or sometimes I'll stay awake at night and run with them. But anyone who, for me, and I am speaking only for myself, anyone who waits for inspiration, that's a tough gig. I believe writing is a discipline. It's an art. It's a skill. And you have to be lucky enough to have a creative ability. You know, my wife's a great visual artist. She could, and has tried to teach me a little bit how to draw, and she could spend the next million years and I will never get it. I have no ability. I can visualize things very well, and I can write about art, but I cannot do art. Visual.
Well, I guess it's good that you recognize that.
It sure is. I mean, but you know, I a lot of people don't like this comment, but I've said it before. When it comes to talent as an artist, whether it's writing or music or visual art, dance, you either have it or you don't. You can teach someone how to be a better writer. You can teach someone how to be good at something, but to make that leap. I use this example. When I was young and played basketball, my coach said, you know, I can't make you tall. It was a nice way of saying I can't give you really good reflexes also, but, you know, I could shoot. That's the one thing I could teach myself to do.
Yeah.
But the other natural abilities, I can't. I can teach someone to write a good sentence, but to actually create great characters, you can either do that or you can't. And you have that ability, and then you have to work really hard at it.
Yeah, and I suppose we both find that as adjunct professors teaching both just like technical writing and also creative writing. So sort of like all the tools, all the technical things, but there's just that sort of intangible factor that has to be in somebody or not to really make it come alive.
Yeah, and, you know, I've been teaching at CalArts in the graduate department for 15 years, and, you know, people have surprised me in what they have gone on to do, that I was unexpecting, and other people who had great abilities didn't have some other necessary qualities, which is the ability to be rejected, demeaned, and spit on dozens, if not hundreds of times.
Yeah. So
there's a whole large area of different disciplines and abilities and skills that allows one to become, and I use this word successful in only in the sense of actually writing something, not whether it sells or gets published or not. Because it's not just having talent, or it's just not having the ability to take rejection or discipline. You have to have all of it. And then there's always the element of luck, but that's more in whether your book gets published or recognized than whether you can write and create it.
No, absolutely. It's a very good sort of perspective to have. And when you mentioned earlier about your characters coming to life and all, I immediately thought of how when American Psycho came out, I think in 90 or 91, the Bret Easton Ellis was always sort of questioned on like the violence of it and how do you condone these things. And I remember, I forget what interview it was in, but he said something to the effect of, you know, I'm as horrified by the things Patrick Bateman does as anybody else. And it always struck me as like, is that a legitimate response? Because you created this character, but you also sort of you have to let it go where it goes.
Yeah, you know, the their Malcolm Toomer character in my book, the Nazi character, some of the things that he says and has done are, you know, absolutely horrifying to me, to use that phrase. But if I could not write him that way, he wouldn't be successful. I mean, the Mindswallow character does some things that, you know, I find fairly, I love that character and he evolves, but, you know, he's not always a very good guy. And, I struggled with writing that because I didn't want to write a character who was at sometimes racist and other shitty things.
Yeah.
You have to fight against that. And that's where a really good editor can help you. My editor, Terry Akers, and in that specific instance, she was really, really good with me about that in saying, this isn't working. You have to, you know, just go for it or not. But right now, you're, you know, she didn't say it this way, but my own ambiguity and feelings about it were not letting me write him the way that he was telling me he needed to be written. And wasn't always nice. And, you know, you can't be responsible if somebody takes your characters and does something shitty because of it. I mean, that's the Nietzschean thing, like blaming the Nazis on him is insane. But
yeah,
you have to do it all the time.
No, absolutely. That's actually a significant amount of, you know, every semester when I teach people how to write, it's always my perspective that in making them write essays and thesis statements and all of that, you have to give them something relevant, something that they're interested in. And one of the things we discuss is whether or not, like, certain forms of entertainment should be held accountable for violence, to what extent should they. There's this really good essay that Marilyn Manson wrote for Rolling Stone 2 months after Columbine, where he's basically talking about the media's involvement and how music isn't to blame and video games aren't to blame, and maybe they're the only escape somebody who's going through some anger and mental issues. You know, maybe that's a good way for them to deal with it. It's not going to spark them doing it. It's going to maybe stop them from doing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's really a complex question. And it has to do with the educational system failing. Coming back in a way to the election, if people are incapable of making a difference between the Donald Trump who appeared on The Apprentice and the Donald Trump who ran for president and the Donald Trump who's basically an immoral bastard.
Yeah.
that the people are, you know, the media has taken a lot of hits for the way that they handled the election, and I personally don't think that's entirely fair.
Mm-hmm.
Since pretty much every newspaper, major newspaper in the country, endorsed Hillary Clinton, even ones who've never endorsed a Democrat before, and it didn't matter because people either didn't care, didn't read the newspaper, or are incapable of making a critical decision. So if somebody blames Columbine on a video game or a TV show, I think that they are not assessing the culture correctly.
Yeah.
And not assessing our educational system correctly. I am not saying that the culture is not, that people's actions are not influenced by cultures. We know that by the idea of the copycat crimes.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that assigning that blame to a video game as opposed to assigning the blame for the availability of guns is that's really bad thinking. So,
yeah, it moves into like anti-rationalism, anti-intellectualism.
Right. Well, of which there is far too much in this country.
Yeah. Plus, what they call, you know, confirmation bias, binary thinking.
Right.
And every time I teach that essay and we talk about it, I bring up, you know, Charles Manson, who heard Helter, you know, the whole White Album he thought was.
Right, right.
But Helter Skelter in particular, which is about a sliding board, it's very, like, literal, you know, it's in the lyrics about a sliding board, and he thought it was about, you know, racial uprising and all. So who do you, you know, do you blame? And just like the Beatles, I'm sure, were asked, obviously I didn't live through it, but I'm sure the Beatles were asked, you know, how do you feel about this, in the same way that, like, Christopher Nolan for The Dark Knight Rises was asked, you know, this guy just shot a bunch of people at the premiere of your movie. How does this make you feel? Do you feel, like, culpable in this at all?
The Beatles weren't culpable. There were no secret messages.
Unless you played it backward. Paul is dead stuff.
People don't even realize that it was McCartney who wrote that song and not Lennon. So
yeah, that's a good point.
So, you know, they're saying blaming John. I mean, look, there is unquestioned about the power of the media, the power of the internet. I wrote a lot about that in Broken Sleep, that we don't know where that power is going.
Mm-hmm.
Hands of the wrong people. There's no doubt. To go back to the ultimate example, the Nazis were extremely good at using the propaganda of their time to convince people. But still, if you want to have an optimistic view of humanity, you have to believe that people are smart enough to figure out what's bullshit and what's not. The problem is that maybe I'm wrong, and people are not smart enough, and they are victims of, if they hear enough times over and over and over again, X is actually X when it's obvious it's not true. I mean, for me, and this is because I'm obsessed with this right now, is I don't understand how there's not one person alive in this country over the age of 10 who did not know about Donald Trump's pussy grabbing tape.
Yeah.
And so he won. He won 53% of white women. So who is at fault for that? It's there. And people chose to ignore that or think that's okay. And I have very left wing friends who blame the Clinton campaign for not doing X or Y, and I don't see it that way. I think people know what she stood for, know what she wanted to do, and made their decision that it was okay to elect a homophobic, xenophobic, racist, sexist guy who's probably never read a book from beginning to end in his entire life.
Yeah.
And I find that both despicable and terrifying.
Yeah, as do I.
So if you're going to blame the media for X, the media exposed Donald Trump for what he is. he exposed himself for what he is, and it didn't matter. So where the responsibility and the power is, I don't have an answer.
No, this is, I mean, I'm looking forward to sort of, I'm not happy this happened, obviously, but I'm glad that I'm alive at a time when something so unprecedented and so, like, I don't know, just hard to comprehend happened, so that, you know, decades from now it'll be talked about, it'll still be talked about and written in history books, and, yeah, I could say I lived through that, even though it's probably not a good thing.
No, I think it's, I'd rather live through this. My biggest problem is, and without sounding self-promoting, I think I wrote a lot about this in Broken Sleep, because I could see it coming, and I don't understand how certain people in the Democratic Party did not see this coming.
The whole, like, silent majority aspect of the polls and all, too.
Yeah, it was, I've spoken a bunch with Steve Erickson, a great novelist and friend of mine who was the editor-in-chief of Black Clock, and he was always afraid that Trump would win, as was I, and we were emailing, and I kept saying, my big fear is she wins the popular vote because of California.
Yeah.
And New York, and she loses the Electoral College, and it's one of those times when, you know, you don't get any points for being right. You just want to wish other people had seen what was, to me, a fairly high possibility of happening.
Yeah, and then you have a bunch of people voting for Harambe, the gorilla or whatever. And thinking it's a joke. Like, it isn't a joke.
Yeah, it's not a joke.
So going along with that, though, you recently posted the lyrics to Paul Simon's American Tune on Facebook. So that was interesting. Granted, my perspective isn't as, like, well-rounded, I guess, and expansive as it could be. But I consider him, like, the greatest American songwriter, at least of the last 50, 60 years. How are you? It sounds like you're writing a lot. It sounds like you're very vocal about your reaction to this. I wonder, what responsibility do you think creative people in general have in expressing social commentary on such events? Because there's a lot of people who think that artists, you know, I guess specifically musicians, should just play songs and not be vocal about it. But of course, people like Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan and the Beatles too change that. So do you think creative people have a responsibility to comment on these things?
Absolutely. 100%. I don't know if you remember. I actually just did a Facebook conversation with a class of college students at Glendale Community College, and all their questions actually a large amount of their questions focused on the section in Broken Sleep where the Mind Swallow character is speaking with Nathaniel Brockton, who is a 60s radical, sort of Abby Hoffman type, Dellinger kind of character. And they focused in on the section where Nathaniel talks about how American artists who don't believe that they are responsible for the political situation are cowards. And because there have been a great many American novelists, songwriters who have spoken out but don't believe their work should be political, and yeah. I wouldn't call them cowards, that's Nathaniel speaking, but I think that it's absolutely essential and for all kinds of public figures to speak out, and artists, writers, musicians, I think it's more important than ever, but we have far too many people who are afraid to speak out. To go back to Michael Jordan, when he was asked about why he wouldn't speak out, and his answer is Republicans buy sneakers too, and that's fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
I respect LeBron James for speaking out, and, you know, American Tune is, I don't know if I consider him the greatest American songwriter, but he's something special in American tune. I mean, the lyrics to that are just, they're just, you know, they make me cry.
Oh, yeah. And clearly, I mean, I named the journal after Bookends.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, but that song, you know, just the imagery.
Yeah.
The Statue of Liberty floating out and not a soul who hasn't been broken. It's just there. And his voice is, I like it. There's a live version he did on Dick Cavett,
mm-hmm.
which is YouTube, which I especially like. But the artist, we as artists, you know, must act, must write, must sing. And, you know, Springsteen did at the end. I wish he had done more. And then, you know, he called mm-hmm. shit calling Trump basically a moron. But people need to do that. And whatever influence anyone has, they need to use in the best possible way. I don't know how it works that, you know, the academia is called elitist and problematical, and that's a problem too. So the anti-intellectual spirit that has been in America from the very beginning, it's not new.
Yeah.
Is always been a problem that's been unsolved, and what is never talked about. I mean, Sanders talked about during his campaign about free education,
mm-hmm.
college education, but, you know, we're still at a point where under one third of all Americans have a 4-year college degree. In Los Angeles County, more people have not graduated high school, if you count illegal immigrants, and have actually graduated from college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's that's something that's never talked about here. I mean, it's both segments, the high school non-graduates, graduates, and the people with graduate degrees are very liberal, so nobody talks about it in L.A., but that divide is still huge. So, and it's worse in other parts of the country in terms of attitude, if not in actual percentages. And I have a belief about something that very few people I know believe in, and that is I would outlaw every private high school, religious school, private college in the country and make it all necessary public education. And I would institute a draft that every person has to serve the country.
Hmm.
I think that would be a way to cross a lot of divides.
Yeah.
But I don't believe either one of those is going to happen anytime soon.
No, probably not. But it's good of you. I mean, you sound very convicted in your beliefs, which is great, and so am I. As you said, people are afraid to speak out about it, and I guess it was the day after he won, I thought whether or not I should post something on the Bookends Twitter and Facebook about it. And I just, to me, it wasn't even like a Democrat versus Republican thing. It wasn't even about party. It was just about like the two people and somebody, one of whom is just so qualified and just an adult, and the other one is just sort of like, how could this have happened? So I did feel the need to just sort of take a side as on behalf of the journal to just sort of say, like, we stand with Hillary's, not even necessarily as a person, but just like the anti-bigotry, the anti-isms that ensued, as we saw, they did ensue with swastikas and anti-Muslim and all that stuff. And even in this, like, I imagine anybody who's listening to this, if they supported Trump, they may be angered by it. But it's not, the answer isn't to, like, turn away from it. It's to, I don't know, get back in the debate or state your side of it. Because I do have empathy for certain Trump supporters in the sense of people who were sick of the bureaucracy and the system, and they wanted somebody who wasn't a politician to not play the game and to restore jobs and to be for the people. I empathize with that. That's kind of what Sanders was. It's just Trump clearly isn't the person.
Well, that in that little section I talked about that the Glendale College kids talked out, they picked out one specific sentence when the Mind Swallow character in Alchemy and Nathaniel are speaking, and it takes place in 92, and the Mind Swallow character says, my father is supporting the Perot guy, and Nathaniel says, why? And he says, because he ain't one of them. And the ain't one of them is the big thing. The problem is Trump is the exact wrong ain't one of them. And more than that, he may not be a politician, but he's a member of, you know, the 0.1% of wealthy people who went to private schools, who never had to deal with regular, normal human beings.
Yeah.
And when he did, he was running a housing project that was sued for racism. So to choose someone because they are not part of the system, just because that's, you want something different, is not thinking. Hillary Clinton, just by default, no matter how much people think she's part of the system and her husband was president, she's been senator, she's a woman. That makes her different.
Yeah.
We've never had that before. By default, she has always been outside the system, no matter what anybody says. And I think that was not made clear enough. That I read an article recently that said, well, she was a flawed candidate. Well, I said, you name me a president who hasn't been flawed, and I'll show you where they are. Because even a guy like Obama, who I really love, he has some pretty large flaws that are overlooked because he is so charismatic.
That's a good point,
So this flaw, she was a flawed candidate, to me, is just a non-starter, and it's just another excuse for sexism.
I agree. To go back to the book, just for a bit.
Okay.
So you mentioned that, clearly it is lengthier. It's about 650 pages, 630, which isn't quite twice as long as the other one, and I'm not sure about how they compare in terms of word count. But did you know it was going to be this lengthy from the start? And I wonder if whether or not that's true, how did it affect the ease or difficulty of bringing it to life and finishing it?
I knew it was going to be longer. I didn't realize how much longer. It's word count is a lot longer.
That's what I thought.
It's at least a third to almost twice as long. But 100 pages in, I realized that it was going to be much longer. I'd always wanted to write something like this. In preparation for writing the book, I reread Anna Karenina, War and Peace, Life of Fate, Dostoevsky, quite a lot of long books, just to get a kind of idea of how that was worked for them. And even though structurally my book isn't like those, it's like some others. One of the things I also tell my students, as well as just anyone who will listen, art is not a rush. If you rush to put something out, especially, you know, publishers want, if your book is semi-successful, they want something fast. If it's not successful, they don't give a shit. But then you will feel the pressure to put something out, so maybe it will be. And a book takes as long as it takes. And I never felt any compulsion to rush it for any other reason, except when it was done, my mom was sick and I wanted it out, which didn't happen before she passed away.
Sorry to hear that.
That's the only reason. Otherwise, it just is. I mean, she had a good long life. So, otherwise, you take your time. And I had an immense amount of joy writing the book. I had so much fun that, you know, I wasn't worried about anything after finishing it is something else. There's being a writer, and then there's dealing with the business side of publishing and all that shit, and that sucks. And I don't really like it, and I just feel lucky enough to I've written a book that I like and a few people like and gotten it published. Can't ask for more than that. You can want more than that, but you can't ask for it.
No, and you've gotten a lot of praise for the book, obviously, not only for me, obviously, as a writer for Pop Matters, but the Rumpus and Kirkus Review, and just filled with praise for it. Much deserved, obviously, too.
Thank you.
But as you say,
loved your review, by the way.
Thank you. I try.
Yeah, no, you succeeded.
Thank you.
You succeeded.
I always get a thrill out of seeing it, referenced. I don't know if it's pathetic, I don't know. But every time, I send it to an author or I send it to, a PR rep or something, here's my review, and feel free to quote it, wherever you want. Feel free to use it. That's what it's all about.
We love praise.
Yeah.
And especially when the reviewer gets it. More for the first book than this one. I got some really nice reviews, but the people, I don't think, understood the book. So I'll take the praise, but really, you kind of missed it. But that's all part of it. And I've been very lucky, in that I've received a lot of praise. But it's also, I will say this straight out, it's very hard to sell a book that's 650 pages.
Well, I'm sure.
It's hard to sell it to a publisher, and it's hard to sell it to readers. And my first book was done by quite a lot of book clubs, and this book is not. And it's based solely on the length of the book, that the book clubs don't want to read a 630-page book, which I also find disturbing personally, of course, because I'd like more people to read my book, but disturbing about making a choice not on quality but on page count and speed and how the world has changed. When I went through reading those long books, I did that in preparation, and I loved reading long books as a kid. I hated when a long book ended. And if people are reading a book for a book club because they have to read it in a month and then talk about it as opposed to actually really enjoy the book and the experience of reading it. I remember when I was 21, I read The Magic Mountain, which I loved at the time and have a lesser opinion of now, decades later. But I read it really fast the first time in, a few weeks. And then I took almost 4 months to reread it to try and get what Mon was getting at. And reading a book should be pleasurable, and just like writing it, shouldn't be something that you rush through. If you rush through it, maybe you should reread it again. That's my thing, but people spend their time doing a lot of other things these days, and time seems to have become compressed and rushed. Life is short, but however short it is, we should take our time enjoying the things we love and not saying, excuse me, I've done this, this, and this today, as opposed to, hey, I just read a book today. Cool.
No, it's a good point. Every semester, in terms of really understanding what a book's about and taking the time to do that, every semester I teach Fight Club. Chuck Palahniuk's debut, even though it wasn't the first book he wrote, it was the first book he published. And every time I tell people that, and I always wanted to teach that even when I was in college, people say, you're going to teach a book about a bunch of guys pitting each other. And I said, it's not, Fight Club is not about a bunch of guys. I mean, it is, right? But it's about consumerism. It's about identity. It's, to me, above all else, it's about cultism. And not to not to keep going back to Trump, but it was very sort of fortunate, I guess, this semester, I think last semester too, to have him doing all that stuff, because it's very much about how somebody could just stand on the soapbox, and no matter what people say, even looking at Manson, looking at and every other cult, basically, and people will follow. And so I make my every chapter when I teach it, I have discussion questions. I make my students go line by line almost with me, read it again in class, and I point out things they may not have noticed. And it really, unveils like the layers of the book, I think, that they don't expect.
Yeah, and good books have multi-layers and multiple ways of reading and understanding. And, you know, Fight Club has a fan base, I would assume, that doesn't get all those layers. So it's a really, I mean, I don't know, and I
can't get
it off, but I think it's important to understand that, you know, I don't think he planned or, you know, said I'm going to write a book about this and it's going to be a big seller and call it Fight Club. I don't know him, never met him. I think he wrote about his obsession and understanding, and the book caught a kind of zeitgeist in a way that there are people reading it because it's about fighting, and there are people reading it to try and understand how we got to the point where there is a cult of fighting. You know, I do not say understand. I'm a sports nut. I do not understand UFC fighting. It scares the crap out of me, and it scares the crap out of me in its immense popularity, and also knowing that the people who started it are big Trumpers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the great irony of Fight Club is that there actually are fight clubs.
Right, right.
And sort of, like, people seem to have missed the entire, like, point of the book if they just, like, oh, start a fight club.
Right.
And he's the afterword to the version I have, the afterword, where he's basically just talking about meeting all these people who come up to him and they know who he is. I mean, at first it must have been crazy that, like, you have this movie based on it, and everybody thinks it was a movie first, and nobody knew it was a book. That's its own sort of struggle, I'm sure. But the people say all these all the nasty things they do to people's food, as if Chuck Palahniuk would be, like, happy about it. And I imagine he's just sort of saying, like, didn't you understand, like, that this is what I was warning you about? Don't do this. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, well, that'd be weird. That goes back to a lot of misinterpretations of people taking what they want from books, and, you know, it's not his responsibility. He was trying to do something else.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, the whole movie relation, book relation is a weird thing. I remember my first book was Options. Never got made. And I was happy on a couple of levels. One, I got some money. Two, it made my mom and dad really happy to read about me in Variety.
Yeah.
But also, I realized that there is a huge disconnect in what can happen to a book when it's taken to film. And as a writer, mostly you lose control of that. And that's strange thing. It doesn't mean I would love Broken Sleep to be optioned and made into an Amazon series, but, you know, I will not be part of it if it is. And this situation is odd because if you sell a lot of books, you will sell 100,000 copies. That's a huge amount of books for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And if 100,000 people see a movie, the movie is a disaster.
Yeah.
So if anyone wants to be a novelist these days, you have to realize that the average literary novel sells between, say, 3,000 and 10,000 copies. One of the dark, horrible secrets of publishing. And I realize if I write a sports piece, which I write for a site called Ethos every once in a while, which I write for free. I probably have more people who read that sports piece than will ever have read my novels. And I get that. And it's okay. It's just you make your choices about what your passion is. And my passion is writing novels that, you know, that it's just, I'm never going to write a novel that's going to sell a million copies. And that's fine. And, you know, that's why one would want the movies to happen. And when that happened with Fight Club and people thought it was a movie first, I imagine that is both amusing and appalling. But what the hell?
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly famous enough now on his own. He's done a lot since. And I kind of, I'm curious about the sequel, but I'm also against it existing. So I haven't read it. I don't know if I'm going to.
I kind of hope he doesn't, but I understand why he would want to for a lot of reasons. You know, even in, you know, would be considered my smaller readership, a lot of people have asked me if I'm going to write sort of books with characters from both my books in it in the future. It's always nice when someone wants you to do that, but
yeah,
when you're done with a book, maybe you're done with it, maybe you're not. I mean, there are people, like I mentioned, Steve Erickson, characters reappear in his books continually throughout his career. Pynchon has taken characters who appeared in two lines in his book and then written a whole novel about them. So,
oh, wow.
You know, writers work in their own universes, and one of the reasons I wanted to become a novelist was because I could escape into a universe that was my own, and even though horrible things may happen, it's still better than the world I was living in most of the time. So,
yeah, it's definitely a sort of cathartic escapism.
Yeah.
Too.
And it's a joy. For me, it's a joy. So,
yeah.
Like, people ask me all the time, isn't writing hard and isn't it difficult? I said, yeah, of course. But anything good is hard and difficult.
Yeah.
But the second I stop enjoying writing is the day I quit writing and just go, you know, hang out.
Yeah. You got to do it for yourself and before anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds terribly narcissistic, but I was actually asked early on, another press bought the book way before it was finished, but who's the audience for this book? And I said, I don't know. I'm writing it for myself. You're the guys who bought it. You find the audience.
Yeah, you market it.
I don't think about that. I don't believe any author should think about their audience, with the exception of someone who gets maybe paid $1 million to write a book for a certain audience. Then I might think about it. But otherwise, write what appeals to you. I mean, Broken Sleep deals with my obsessions, which is music, art, family identity, and politics. And that's what I'm obsessed with, so that's what I write about. I mean, I could never write a book about, you know, rowing or something like that.
Yeah. That's a good segue into what I was going to ask you, too. You mentioned your characters. You already said a little bit about Salome, but I was wondering about Alchemy. He's the half-brother of Moses, how he's a very famous rock band. He's in a rock band, very famous rock band, and he's living that sort of typical glamorized rock star lifestyle. So I wonder if he's based on any specific musicians or bands, and how big of a part does music play in both your creative process and just life in general?
Well, music, I mean, I've been obsessed with music, and especially rock and roll music, since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I wrote a little bit about it. I have really good friends who started a tremendous fanzine, the Trouser Press. And so, you know, I'm an older guy, so I was at CBGB's really early when it started. I was really young. But so I've always been obsessed with music. I've met a lot of rock stars briefly, most of whom are not that impressive as persons as opposed to their stage presence.
Yeah.
Alchemy is based somewhat on that. He's a Christ figure as well.
Yeah.
I mean, his name is Alchemy because his personality changes to whatever people want him to appear as. He appears to them as that. He's not based on any one person or anything. He's an amalgamation of a lot of people I've met, his transition from rock star, you know, lead singer of the Insatiables to politician, to me, was implicit from the opening line of the book, where Salome quotes him as saying, I am large, I consume multitudes, which is a riff off of Whitman. And so he was always going to go in that direction. And it was also both serious and a satire on, and this is way before Trump happened, on celebrities being taken way more seriously than they should. And in Alchemy's case, he's a really smart guy, but without Moses sort of like helping him, he'd be more in trouble politically because he doesn't know that much.
Yeah.
You know, and Moses is a history professor. So when they come together, it's they're a really good team. But, you know, this is pre-Trump, but the idea that Schwarzenegger and Ronald Reagan and Jesse Ventura all won political positions of power and none of the three were actually really ready to be politicians. Ronald Reagan was president for 8 years, and Ronald Reagan, you know, I am quite convinced if you put a world map in front of him, he could not find Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So, he had a lot of people I disagreed with intensely, but at least he had some really intelligent advisors.
Yeah, it's really important.
Which so their agenda I found pretty horrible. I received an email from a friend and said she's been waiting for the shoe to drop since Nixon. And I said, wow. Oh, well, the shoe dropped. Reagan got elected. It just took until Trump for it to hit the ground. And now we're going to have an earthquake because Trump's agenda, and no one really wants to talk about this because Reagan comes off as a sweet old guy, which he was not. Their agendas are very, very similar. If you watch Reagan's use of welfare queen and other symbolic language, it's not that big a jump to what Trump did.
No, I totally agree. And also, I mean, I, as you know, like, my main, even beyond like this journal, beyond teaching, my main number one passion is writing about music. So I incorporate references. I guess it's like a gimmick. It's just I try to incorporate like at least one music reference in everything I write. And I find like I'm in 2 weeks actually, or actually next Saturday, December 3rd, I'll be 29. So I find that the music I listen to is sort of atypical for my age group. I grew up listening, you know, I was 13 going into high school, my dad played me, like, what I consider real Genesis, as in 70s right. Genesis.
Right, right.
And, Gabriel. Yeah, and Jethro Tull and King Crimson and all that stuff. So I always flock, like, you know, among all the other aspects of the book, like, the fact that Alchemy is who he is and all the music that's tied into it definitely intrigued me, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I saw King Crimson, so a later version, but still, Fripp was still there. And so, you know, music has just been, during the years of writing the book, I listened to thousands upon thousands of songs. I have a list. I was keeping lists in my studio.
Oh.
And I maybe did not get all of them, but it ranges from, you know, Louis Armstrong to King Crimson to Television to, you know, Marvin the Vandellas to Springsteen to John Cage. I mean, I listen to everything.
That's really eclectic.
Writing the book. I mean, each chapter to me should have a certain musical sound to it. One of my really good readers, and I have a couple of really good readers, his name is Anthony Miller. I actually did a talk with him last week, and he read the Malcolm Toomer section, the one that's narrated by him, and he said reading it, he heard Sympathy for the Devil. I went back, and it was much longer at first. And when I went back, I would play that song every day before I rewrote that chapter till I could hear those rhythms and cut it so I could hear it like that killer cutting guitar of Keith Richards.
Mm-hmm.
And then just to have those rhythms. And there are the last chapter, which is, this is not a spoiler, because from earlier on, you know, alchemy is going to die. And that,
yeah.
I read that for the last time. And that to me, I had very definite music in my head when I wrote that. A lot of chapters that, you know, a lot of Mindfall chapters should sound sort of like, you know, the Ramones. his style of speaking. And so everything is different like that. The short Hana chapters to me are very Sinatra-esque.
Okay.
If you were to read it. So music, there's a great essay by William Gass called The Music of Prose. And he talks about how prose is obviously not music, but it should have a music. You can't make it music. And, you know, I may fail, but I want my prose to have its own music. And in the word was, there were definite seconds where I was not in content, but in rhythm. I was purposefully imitating certain Kerouac in some places. And a couple of people have caught on to that. I was very happy about it. So, yeah, without, you know, in my life, the first thing I wanted to be was a professional athlete. Well, I was not very good. Then I wanted to be a rock star, and I was not very good. So I became a writer, and I've written about sports, but not that much fiction, although I'm working on a short story about that now.
Okay.
But music, The Insatiables as a band, I mean, they're serious, but just by their mere name is a sort of parody of the ridiculousness of rock bands who say they can only have orange M&Ms in their suite before they go on stage.
You know, the excessive demands.
The excessive
demigods.
Yeah. So I tried to play that both ways, that they're both very serious, a really great band. I mean, one of the only lyrics that I quote at length, I mean, a lot of the songs that are quoted in there, I have full lyric sheets for them. It is, the one is where Alchemy is parodying the Sermon on the Mount. And that was very purposeful. And it was sort of making fun of Dylan at the same time.
It's easy to do.
There's even there's a line I can't remember, but they asked me for some collateral, so, you know, because Dylan makes that joke, and I made a joke about him dropping his pants. Which is also a joke on Jagger and Give Me Shelter, when he says, "We don't want my trousers to fall down now, do we?" And all the girls yell, "Yes, we do."
They go crazy.
Yeah.
The madness of it all.
Yeah, so I was trying to capture that. And also try to give insight into our society that is just celebrity obsessed in a very bad way.
No, definitely is. So then, as you've said, you're an instructor at Cal Arts MFA Writing Program. And you were, past tense, you were an editor at Black Clock, but I'll get to that in a second.
Right.
So I wonder how you, as with every creative type, sort of like the general question of just how do you balance, like, your teaching and all these other things with writing? How do you find time to write?
Okay, I've been teaching. I teach also in the undergrad program. I've been what is called a half-time, three-quarter-time adjunct for, I don't know, a long time now. I'm lucky enough to get benefits, but I'm not full-time, which is really good because I don't have to go to meetings. But but between editing, you know, having a family life, teaching. This is this is harsh, but if you, again, Steve Erickson and I were talking about this the other day. Steve, who's editor-in-chief of Black Clock, he taught at CalArts, now he's at UCR. He has family, he writes a movie column. When I started teaching at CalArts, I was also writing a column about visual art for about 5 years. And there are people who are just obsessed, and I was obsessed, and you will find time to write your books if you're obsessed. I have friends who are always saying, I can't find time to write, and they have much less to do. I have another friend, Joanna Scott. I think she's a great, great novelist. She's written like 12 books. She teaches at Rochester. She helps run their foreign translation press. She's got kids, all these things. She finds time. And then there are other people who have much less work, much less responsibilities, and they can't finish a book or they can't do a painting. And it's just obsession and discipline.
Yeah.
And it's way easier to find an excuse not to write than it is to write. Believe me, every Sunday I would rather stay home and watch a football game when I'm writing a book, and I just leave and go to my studio where I don't have any internet connection, where I don't have anything, because that's when I have to write. And every day I can find an excuse to not write. And that's true with everyone. So finding that balance of time is just like, well, you make sacrifices. You don't go out to dinner and get drunk with your friends.
Yeah.
Something I did a whole lot in my 20s, I will admit. You know, when I lived in New York, I grew up in Queens, and I had hundreds of friends there, literally, or acquaintances. And people would call me, hey, you want to go to this concert? You want to go to the museum? You want to go to the Knick game? And I would always say yes. And I realized you have to say no to almost all of that. And that is the time that you need to do your art. If you're teaching and working a job and editing a magazine, and it's not always easy to do that. Matter of fact, it's really hard, but
yeah.
For me, I don't regret for a second what I've done. I traveled a lot and did a lot of stuff when I was in my 20s and early 30s, when other people were publishing books, and I sometimes think, well, maybe I should have done that, but no, I wanted to have fun too, so I've been able to do books.
That's good. I mean, that's the struggle I always think too, is sort of like, for example, like today, I think back and I graded some papers, I reviewed the new Gong album, and I'm, you know, speaking with you for over an hour, so I figure, so I know part of me, when we're done doing this and I finish the Gong review and upload it, I'll think, okay, that was enough for today. Now I can watch Netflix or play PlayStation or something. But as you're saying, if I really am dedicated, I should focus on writing my creative things too.
That's the thing, because I agree with you. I mean, I don't have classes this week because of Thanksgiving, but normally we'd get off this and I would have, you know, a couple hundred pages to read between my classes for this week. And I would do that. And then at night, I'm starting to sketch out things for my next novel and just write little stuff. But yeah, when we get off, I would rather go watch the football game or, you know, read something. But, you know, if you want to write a book, you just say no to Netflix and no to this or no to whatever your obsessions are, where you say, okay, I'm going to do this for an hour, and then I'm going to go write. And if that doesn't happen, I have a really a good friend who 14 years ago wrote a really terrific book, and he's never written one since. And I don't know why, but I have a really good feeling, and it's a combination of fear and that he'd rather go have fun. And that's okay if he is okay with in the end, when he looks back when he's 65 or whatever and says, well, you know, I just wrote one book and it's okay. I for myself have always had this idea of a trilogy of novels. I've gotten two of them done. I'm working on the third, and you know, I realized I was not going to be Charles Dickens really early on, that he's a genius in a way that I am not, and I'm not going to write 20 books or 10 books. So you also have to accept that within yourself, and I'm pretty much at peace with what I've done and what I hope to do. You know?
That's great.
I don't get run over by a car and I write one more book. Cool, you know? And I had fun doing it.
That's all you can hope for. It's pretty good.
Yeah. I think you have to have, you know, both realistic expectations without hindering your ambitions, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of my young students, they ask me quite often, well, who do you think is going to last and be read in 100 years? I said, almost no one, and no one knows who they are, because, you know, when I was young, everybody read Norman Mailer. I haven't had a student in 13 years, or I've had two out of all the students I've had in 13, 15 years, whatever it is, who've read Norman Mailer. They don't like them, but they haven't read them to know why they shouldn't like them. But if you ask people in 1970, when he was going Pulitzer Prizes and selling a lot of books, that in 2016 that he would be hardly read, no one would have believed it.
Yeah, definitely. To predict those things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't predict those. You know, Donald Barthelme was another one, and every once in a while people try and have a Barthelme, you know, revival, and it goes nowhere. So, you know, it's really good to be 25 and wonder and hope for those things to me. But it's also one of the things I used to do, but I've stopped because I realized it was kind of depressing my students, was you name me two novels from every decade of the 20th century, but you can't use Hemingway twice, can't use Faulkner twice, whatever. And most of them couldn't do it. So, and you're worried about immortality? Give me a break, okay? You know, just do your work and hope for the best.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I guess, pretty much the final question I have for you is regarding Black Clock, which, from what I've read, ceased publication in June of this year.
Right.
And I've read that neither the students nor the faculty really were prepared for it or asked about it or anything. So what is your response to, I mean, how did you find out it was ending? How did you feel about it? How do you feel about it now?
I feel shitty. I felt shitty then.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated subject. I mean, the Jeff Vandermeer wrote, I think, a pretty good article about it for LitHub. He contacted me. Both Steve Erickson and I refused to be quoted in it because we didn't want to get into it.
Yeah.
Until the administration said that we were the ones who decided that the website should be closed and the Facebook should be closed, and then Steve responded to that saying, no, that's not true, and it's not true. We did not make that decision. We were caught. We were blindsided about it being closed. In all the years the magazine was in existence, especially after the first two, I, as the senior editor, had been included in almost every single meeting with the president, the provost, the deans, the CFOs, all these people. And then in January of 15, a meeting was called, which I was not invited to.
Oh.
And Steve was told at that meeting, you're being closed next year. And then I was told later in the day, maybe the next day, I don't remember, by my dean that it was being closed. And
wow.
We were never, as far as I'm concerned, we were never given a sufficient reason. In the LitHub article, they said, the administration said, it was because Steve had left for UCR and LaSalle Arts. But I'll just leave it at that. I'm very disappointed. They're starting a new online magazine that Maggie Nelson's going to run. I'm hoping for the best, but I'm not involved in it.
Okay. And,
you know, academic administrative politics are something I very gladly not involved in.
It's probably, you know, sounds like a good decision.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of people who get involved in that, and I think it hinders their creative stuff. I want to write my books, stories, teach, and be left alone.
That's good. It sounds like you're able to do all of that. Find a nice balance.
Yeah, it's hard. It's always hard. But, you know, I'm very lucky to be married to someone who's a visual artist, a successful visual artist. But she absolutely understands the obsessions and the needs to do this. And I think that's a really good thing. If I were with a civilian, I often wonder, as I call them, who worked a 9-to-5 job, who wouldn't get that. But
no, absolutely.
To get a supportive partner when you're doing something that is so tenuous in terms of how it's defined as success and how hard it is and how much rejection it is, it's really good to be with someone who gets that.
No, I imagine so. Sounds like you guys really support each other.
Oh, yeah. We're each our biggest supporters. And
it's great.
Often we need to be.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for taking the time to speak with me. I think this is great. Very, very interesting.
Thanks, Jordan. I really appreciate it.
Well, likewise.
I hope it worked out. And I super support your magazine. I hope that worked out. And